Begin the Dhamma talk. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta te sangamatasa dwara yeso tavanto pamanchantu sadhante. So for this evening's Dhamma talk, I thought I might just talk a little bit more about the meditation we just did and what it kind of, how it fits in the Buddhist philosophy and way of living and so on. Now, meditation we just did, we just investigated our skeleton. Now, because it was a very short meditation, we just did it fairly briefly and fairly quickly. And we didn't have a chance to really sort of go into that at all deeply. But of course, like any other kind of meditation, you know, the rewards that we get out of it depend on the efforts that we put into it. Within the Buddhist, the way that the Buddha thought, that question of the problem of death is one of the basic problems. Before the Buddha, most of you have heard the traditional legend of how it is that the Buddha came to go forth and go forth on what he called the Arya Pariyasana, the spiritual quest. And one of the things that spurred him on that quest was seeing a dead person, seeing a corpse. And that sight of death, is one of the great question marks, isn't it? What actually is it? You look at somebody who's died and they look just the same as you and I, right? But there's something different. And it's very kind of strange. It's a very odd experience. Of course, part of how, again, according to the legend, hello, Chris. Thank you. Very good. We have sound back. Thank you very much for this lesson in impermanence. It's very helpful. So, again, according to the legend, that the Buddha's father hid the truth of life from him, right? Hid all of the dead people and so on away from him. And it always strikes me that this is very much how we've chosen to live, right? In our society, right? We hide all of the dead people, sick, dead people, we put them away. The sick people, we hide them away in the hospitals. Old people, we hide away in the nursing homes. And we sort of live our life as if these things aren't really real, or if they are real, they don't really impact us very much. One of my earliest memories of Thailand when I travelled there as a tourist in the early 90s was I was in Chiang Mai and just got walking through the main city square, and in the city square there was some kind of, I can't even remember what it was now, some kind of expo or demonstration or something like that. And part of the expo was a medical exhibit, and they had a couple of dissected corpses on display. Like, seriously, this is just in the main city square, just sitting there, right? And everyone just walking past and having a look at these dissected corpses. And I'm thinking, wow, that's not something you're going to see in Perth anytime soon, right? And that much more kind of relaxed attitude to these things. It's just your body, that's all. It's not such a big deal. So that kind of Buddhist attitude, you kind of understand it, you can see it, and not get too afraid of it or think there's anything too peculiar about it. So there's this funny thing that distinguishes life from death. It's really kind of nothing. And yet, of course, it means everything. You know, we're so worried about it, so neurotic about it. You know, we even if we see a dead person, they're all kind of dressed up and they have makeup on and all of these kinds of things, and they don't even look like they look in the real life. You know, I remember one time we did a funeral service in this very room, as it happened, and it was when I was here last time. It was about, must be 10, 15 years ago. And one of the members of the community had died, and their funeral was held in here, and they had the open coffin, and we sort of filed past and looked at the body there. And I was with one of the other monks, and we're standing at the head of the coffin, and he just sort of whispered to me, "He looks like John Howard." Which he did, right? So we were standing there trying not to giggle, right? And, you know, trying to look suitably serious and so on. Anyway. And so, of course, we have all these kind of taboo notions around dead bodies, right? You can't touch them, you can't see them, you know, but then they have to be treated right. You have to do the proper ceremonies and things like that. And it's a very old part of human culture. It's very strange, you know, you think about it. You know, you go back in human culture 10,000 years or more, and there are people who are burying the dead, right? They're treating these dead bodies as with reverence. Right? There's something meaningful about it, and yet there's nothing there. All around the world, we see people struggling with these questions and these kind of beliefs around death, like fear of ghosts, fear of the dead, all of these kinds of things. You know, vampires and zombies, and it's such a infests our imagination, this fascination with death we see in so many ways. I mean, on a surface level, I guess a shallow level, where you know, death is scary because it's painful or whatever. But beyond pain, the real problem is the unknown. Right? So death is the unknown. And very often we turn to religion to provide the answer for what that is. One time I did an interfaith panel in Sydney. It was in a high school in the western suburbs of Sydney. And it was like me and a rabbi and an imam and a pastor or Catholic priest or something like that, about five or six of us, and a bunch of school kids, and they're asking all of these different questions. And one of the questions they asked is, what happens after we die? And it was very interesting, right? Because here they are, they're asking, you know, we're supposed to be the experts, right? All the kind of religious people. And every single person on that panel, basically, to sum up their answer, was... Their answer was, I don't know, but this is what my tradition teaches. Yeah? And to me, that was a very kind of healthy way of looking at it from a religious or spiritual point of view. Of course we don't know, right? If we think that we know what happened, then we're overstepping. And the Buddha cautioned us against overstating what the evidence is. We might think that it's reasonable to think that we're going to get reborn. We might believe that's probably what's going to happen. We might think that we're going to go to heaven. We might think that there's nothing after we die, right? There's many different opinions we can have on it, and that's fine. And there are, you know, reasons for arguing for and against each opinion and so on. But at the end of the day, we don't really know. And so this is where that kind of emotion of that fear of death comes. So one of the things that we can do through these meditations, the different meditations on death, is we can look at that unknown. We can look at the things that we're normally afraid of. Right? Now, when we're approaching these difficult topics and so on, then we need to approach it within a context which is going to help to keep it safe. And I mentioned before that there was a sort of a slightly unusual voice of caution around these meditations that we find in the early Buddhist texts. And the best example of this is what's sometimes called as the case of the murdered monks. Has anyone heard of that, the case of the murdered monks? is one of the most unusual stories in the whole of the Pali Canon. I'll just summarize it for you. This is found in the Vinaya. And it starts out with the Buddha teaching all of the monks about investigation of the body, looking at the different parts of the body and so on and so forth, like the meditation we did earlier. And then having taught that, the Buddha says, okay, monks, I'm going on retreat. So he went on meditation retreat. I can't remember how long it was for, like a fortnight. Sometimes he would go, sometimes for a few months. Just incidentally, just to sort of notice that if you weren't aware, I mean, this is something that we do find in the suttas and the Vinaya, that the Buddha still went on meditation retreats, right? Actually, I find that kind of very inspiring. People asked him, like, why would you do these things? And he said two reasons. One was because he liked it, he enjoyed it. The other one was because compassion for future generations. Yeah, he's setting an example. Anyway, so the Buddha's away on retreat. And while the Buddha was away on retreat, the monks did these meditations and they became very disgusted with their own bodies. They loathed life. And they wanted to go across, they wanted to get rid of this body. They misunderstood, they thought that the body was the source of their suffering. And so they started taking their own lives. And there was a monastery attendant in there who they encouraged to help the bhikkhus to cross over. So they took a knife and he went round and offered his services to any of the monks who wanted to go over to the far shore. And many of the monks did that, until the whole monastery looked like a shambles. Meanwhile, the Buddha's off enjoying a nice meditation retreat, right? It's a very unusual story. Do not ask me to explain it, okay? Anyway, the Buddha comes off meditation retreat, and this is where the Buddha's kind of deadpan humor sort of kicks in. The Buddha says to Ananda, the Sangha looks strangely depleted, Ananda. And Ananda, equally deadpan, says to the Buddha, it would be good if the Buddha would teach another kind of meditation to the monks. So the Buddha calls the monks in and he teaches them breath meditation, anapanasati. So when we're doing breath meditation, of course, we're contemplating life, right? So the breath is the force of life, the power of life. It's the breath, right, which distinguishes your body, your living body here from a corpse. So meditation on breath is something which the Buddha universally praised. He said it's a pleasant abiding here and now. Yeah, it's entirely peaceful. It's entirely refreshing. Yeah. So it's a meditation that doesn't have any dangers or drawbacks or side effects. Yeah. And so we can do that, recommend that meditation to anybody, and we can do it as much as we like. But now, this story about the murdered monks and so on, was it true? I don't know. It's a very odd story, so whatever. Anyway, don't ask me to explain it. I'm just telling you, okay? But the message of the story, the meaning of the story is clear enough, right? It's that these meditations, right, they are... very meaningful and can be very beneficial, but they're also very powerful. And if they're done in an unbalanced way, then they can have those harmful side effects. So if you're interested to take these things up and take these practices up, then fine, but do it in context and do it in a balanced way. Do plenty of breath meditation, plenty of metta meditation, and then when you're doing the death contemplations and so on, then you can see for yourself what effect they have. Often these kinds of meditations can have unexpected effects, right? See, our relationship with the death and the end of life is not very rational, and it's usually not very sort of coherent or consistent, right? It's where we kind of lock away all of the parts of our mind and fears and desires and so on and so forth. And so when we start to look at that, it's like we start to open the door and then those strange creatures can emerge. And sometimes when you're doing these meditations, you might feel tremendous anxiety might come up. You might feel a tremendous fear come up. You might feel a feeling of despair, despondency, right? Depression. You might just get kind of annoyed, aggravated, So different kind of emotional responses can come at different times, okay? Now, if those things come up from time to time and you know, they might stay for a little while and then go, then it's not such a big problem, right? Don't worry about it too much. Usually you'll find that they will just disappear by themselves, okay? So it's usually not something to worry about. But keep an eye on it. If it gets too much, then you should stop. Right? On the other hand, you can also have a variety of very positive emotional responses that might come up. Right? You might feel, like often there's a sense of interest and fascination with our bodies. Right? This is actually where the samadhi side of the meditation comes from. And sometimes when you're contemplating the bones, you might find that a particular part of the bones might start to glow. Right? Almost because like it's being illuminated by moonlight or something like that. Well, of course, you don't have to do this meditation on bones. I'm just giving this as one example. This is what we did earlier, but many different ways of doing this meditation. But if you're doing that on bones, then you might find that, you know, a particular bone starts to glow. There's like a light inside it. Yeah? And that's a sign that the hindrances are starting to become quiet in your mind, right? The hindrances are being reduced and the mind is becoming clear. Why? Because you're letting go. Right, your attachments are letting go. Right? The fears you have are being letting go. The desire and the attachment you have is letting go. The conceit you have, you're letting go. All of these things you're letting go, and because all of the things are becoming quiet, your mind becomes bright. And when your mind becomes bright, of course, you project that externally. It looks like it's your bone becoming bright. Actually, it's your mind becoming bright. And so that's the beginnings of what we call a nimitta. And if you keep your focus there and sustain your awareness, then gradually that can deepen and deepen and become the basis for deep samadhi. Now, you know, you might want to take the meditation that deeply and to take it into those places. That's fine, that's great. Or you might want to just do it as a more of a kind of a sort of a general reflection. You're not sort of really wanting to take it deeply as a meditation, but just to sometimes to, you know, give yourself a bit of context and wisdom and to use it for reflecting on your life and purpose and so on. And that's also fine, right? So don't think that there's one right way or wrong way of doing it. There are many, many different ways, and they will each have some effect. Now, typically what you'll find when you're doing these meditations is that in the short term, they're certainly not as fun as doing like breath meditation, right? You probably won't feel as peaceful as you do after doing breath meditation. You won't feel as happy as you have after doing loving kindness meditation, okay? So you might feel that the it's not having a strong effect when you in that way. You might do, right? You might get a strong reaction. Sometimes we get a strong like repulsion or feeling like an emotional movement where the mind is sort of almost forcibly letting go and going to a place of emptiness, and you can have a deep sense of peace and stillness which comes out of that meditation. So that may or may not happen, and that's not something you need to worry about, but you just keep on going with the practice little bit by little bit until you feel that that your mind has become some settled and quiet. So this is something, this awareness of what is the impermanence of our lives, right? Is absolutely fundamental in Buddhism. You know, sometimes in the way that impermanence is taught, it's like impermanence means that everything rises and falls, right? But actually, if you look at how the Buddha talked about impermanence, usually what he meant was that our life is going to come to an end. Right? That's impermanence that really matters. Yeah, the fact that this thought has come and gone, frankly, who cares? There'll be another one there in a minute, right? I'm not that particularly attached to this thought, right? But I am attached to this life. And it's the impermanence of this life, ultimately, which really matters to me. Not just my life, but the life of those people around me, yeah? The life of the people that I love. These are the things which our emotions get deeply attached to. If we are spiritual practitioners, if we are people who are intent on expanding our awareness and deepening our consciousness, then our concern will also become deeper, right? So we won't be just concerned with us and our immediate family, but also with people generally, with the planet, right? With animals, right? With all creatures who suffer, any sentient beings, we will also be concerned with them, with their lives, right? With their happiness. And we'll also be distressed when we see them suffer. Yeah? And we will see people suffering in distant lands. I don't even know them. And we hear about people who are dying. I don't even know those people, but I can still suffer with them. We can look at the impermanence, not just of ourselves, but the impermanence of our entire planet. And this also can be something which is very distressful. Right? One of the most striking features in the way that the Buddha talked about these kinds of meditations was he used this phrase, ajata bahidha, internally and externally. And it's one of these things which is found constantly through the early Buddhist texts, and yet is very little emphasized in modern meditation. In modern meditation, especially Vipassana meditation, and it's always talking about impermanence, rising and falling and so on. But then the suttas actually mention this internally and externally just about as often in the context of mindfulness meditation. And yet we rarely hear this being talked about these days. So what this internally, externally idea is essentially that it erases the difference between self and other. Okay, so for example, in this meditation we just did, we started out by looking adhyatam, inside ourselves. Right? So you're looking inside yourself at your own bones, and you're experiencing what those bones are. Now, our experience of our own bones is a subtle and complex thing. Partly, it's a direct experience, like a physical touch. We actually get stimuluses from our nerves so that we can actually feel how the bones are inside our body. Like normally, you don't notice that because our attention is directed outwards, but actually, you can sense what your bones are like inside your body. But in addition to that, there's also the aspect of perception, which is based on memory. Right? So our vision of skeletons and bones we've seen in the past and so on and so forth. And so these kind of work together to create that impression, the overall impression of what our bones look like inside. And through the meditation, depending how still your mind is and how focused your mindfulness, then of course you can clarify that. Now it's not how clear it is will vary a lot from person to person, okay? So it's one of those meditations which people have very individual responses to. Sometimes people will see it as clearly as day. And some people will develop this meditation and you get on the bus and you just see, I'm standing on this bus with a bunch of skeletons. Right? You just see, that's all you see, right? So you go through these different phases in it. But other times you look at it and you see it and there's no real clear perception at all. So it's just a natural variation that people have, okay? So not something to worry about too much. But when we perceive that, I mean, ultimately what you're perceiving from the Buddhist point of view is the elements, right? So the Buddhist way of looking at matter is that matter is made up of these four elements, or perhaps four physical properties might be a better way of talking about it, is earth, water, fire and air, right? And these, of course, are nothing other than those different states of matter that we learnt about in our high school physics, right? There's solid, liquid and gas. And heat is the energy which transforms from one state to the next. Now, our bones are, of course, the earth element, right? So the solidity, primarily, right? All of those elements, according to Buddhist theory of matter, that all of those elements always go together. They're never isolated, but one might predominate. So in the bones, then the earth element is predominating. And we can feel that hardness. And similarly, if you look at other aspects of your body, you can feel the softness or the liquid and so on and so forth. But in the bones, we're seeing the hardness of it. And then we can see that connection between that hardness of those bones inside and what we're seeing outside. As one of the verses in the Theragata talks about a monk who's sitting there who's seeing the whole world, the whole earth, as bone. Right? And so you're eradicating, like erasing the boundary between self and other. Right? And we have these bodies which we get so attached to and we care so much about, but our bodies are not our own, right? Our bodies are constantly leaking, right? Each time we breathe in, air is coming from outside to in. You breathe out, air is coming from inside to out. Yeah? And this is part of who we are, right? A second after I breathed in, that oxygen which I breathed in has been absorbed into the lungs and it's in my bloodstream, right? Where it goes up and circulates around my body, it goes into my brain and it makes my consciousness and my thoughts and things like that, right? But of course, this air that I'm breathing in is air that you have just breathed out, right? So we've been sitting here in this room together for the last hour or so. So I think it's a pretty safe bet to say that there is a little bit of every one of you inside me right now. Yeah? Circulating in my brain right now. And the different parts of my body, firing my neurons, yeah, making my muscles work, my digestive organs, all of those things are bits of you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah. Right? And not just the air, but the, you know, the water is going through the pores and so on, the sweat, and our skin is not a sealed thing by any means. It's porous all the time. And so on and so forth, right? So our bodies are not, we like to think of our bodies as self-contained, and we get kind of nervous or upset. If anything breaks that, then it's kind of icky, isn't it, right? So you go to the toilet, right, and you have urine and feces, and it's like, eww. It's icky, it's nasty, right? Well, actually, it was inside you a minute ago, right? So this is internally and externally, right? Before it was part of you, now it's sitting in a toilet bowl, and it's icky. But did you feel icky before you went to the toilet? No, I'm not icky. But that came out of you, so what's the deal, right? But, you know, and the same with sweat, you know? You feel, oh, you don't like it when your body feels sweaty and so on. So all of these things, which actually is just natural, but it's part of who we are. And we get very kind of attached to it and so on. And you can see that so much of this concern with bodies and with who we are is about sort of maintaining this ideal of a self-contained and unitary thing, like our body, which we think we can control and shape and mold into some perfect form. And trying to fight off old age, right? And fight off death. Adam Brahm is not giving the talk tonight, as some of you may know. He's in America at the moment, and he's giving a talk with Google at the Google Search Within Yourself program. And I'm sure he'll probably talk about that next week. But one of the things that projects that Google's doing is an immortality project, right? So they've gone, it's like we can build a search engine and we can make a nice email service, so why don't we just conquer death, right? That's the kind of the next... And the next one, okay, maybe we'll see how they go, right? But we have all of this kind of wanting to overcome death, and it seems to me that this it's almost kind of neurotic concern to keep our body, preserve it, and so on and so forth is kind of missing the point. And as always, we find, I think, in the world's great wisdom traditions, we find a much more profound appreciation for actually what these things are, right? Now, death, I think, death is full of love. Right? Death makes change possible. Death makes life possible. None of you could be here without death. Yeah? There's a beautiful Hindu myth which talks about this. And I'll just summarize this myth briefly, but as so often with these Hindu mythologies, they sort of, it's very kind of long and complicated, but very briefly, when according to this myth, when Brahma first created the world, Brahma was a very loving god, right? He was just full of love. He wanted to create the world, so he made everything perfect, yeah? Everyone happy, everyone lived forever, yeah? Everyone had all of those things that we look for and we want, right? No one ever got sick, and yeah? No one ever had to be separated from people that you love, yeah? All of those things that you wish for, that's how the world was. That's how Brahma made it, because Brahma's a loving God. Right? Of course, what happened? Well, one of the things that people like, you know, one of the things that people make people happy is children. yay, kids, right? So Brahma gave them kids. He said, okay, there you go. More and more and more. Of course, you know what happened, right? Within a few generations, the whole earth is groaning under the weight of people, right? There's just so many people everywhere multiplying and living forever. What are we going to do? It's just this terrible thing. And so Brahma went away into meditation and he thought, I'm going to have to give my final gift to the world. It's the gift of death. And so he used his depth of his meditation to create the goddess of death. And the goddess of death was a very loving goddess. Of all the goddesses, she was the one who had the most love. And because she knew that her gift was that gift that made life possible. And so he made this goddess and said, she came to him and he said, I've made you for one purpose. You have to bring my greatest gift to the world. And she said, I would be delighted to do that for you. Oh Lord, tell me what is that gift? And he said, the gift of death. You have to bring death to every sentient being in the world. And she said, I can't do that. How can you ask me to do that? Anything else? Ask me to do anything else. I can make the crops grow. I can make the children beautiful. I can make anything happen. But don't ask me to do that. You're asking me to have the bad karma of killing every single sentient being who lives. Right? I can't. And he said, you must. I can't. You must. I can't. This went on for some time. In fact, this went on for like millions of years, according to mythology. And she did all of these things. And she did these ascetic practices. She like stood on one leg for like a million years to sort of try and force Brahma to change his mind and all of these kinds of things. But I won't go into all of those details. But at the end, of course, inevitably, she accepts her fate, right? This is what she has to do. And this is part of nature. And to me, this really shows how powerful that idea of death really is. And death is full of love. Yeah? And when we see our family members have died, people who we love have died, you don't think of that as being something which is sad. You know, why is it sad? How could they leave me? I can't live without you, right? This is just selfishness, right? If you've seen in the descriptions of near-death experiences, you know, one that I remember very, very sort of moved me when I read it was the story of a young girl, you know, like a teenager or something, had drowned in a river. She was like on a bridge or something. She drowned and her family was on the bridge and they saw her and they couldn't save her in time. And she had a near-death experience, right? But afterwards she was revived and she came back and she told what that experience was like. And she said, you know, she felt... the fear and the terror of drowning and so on. But then afterwards she felt like she left her body and she felt just light. She like floated up and she felt full of happiness and bliss. And then she was asked, was there anything painful in that experience at all? And she said, there was one thing which was painful is when I looked down, I saw my parents crying. And I felt sad for my parents and I only wished that they knew how happy I was. So when someone dies and we feel all of these kind of feelings of loss and things like that, remind yourself that those feelings of loss, that's our feeling. Right? We own that. It's not their feeling. What are they feeling? I don't know. Again, maybe they're feeling nothing at all. Maybe they're feeling happy. Maybe they're feeling sad. Who knows? But look after our feeling. Don't blame that person for not supplying you with the happiness that you want. Right? That's not their job. Right? But remember, you understand that death is full of love. Death allows life to happen. And without the dying of the old, there can never be the renewal. And this is how that life works, and this is how samsara works. So as long as we're here, as long as we're within this round of samsara, this is what we participate in. So part of the Buddha's spiritual quest was to look for what is the escape from it, right? See, what is the escape from this? And of course, the naive way of escaping from it is the idea that we can take away death, right? So this is what the Google project wants to do. They want to use technology to do it, right? We can take away aging, take away death. Imagine what kind of world that would be in, right? Imagine if it really worked. Yeah, imagine if that worked. You could stop everybody from dying. There's one of the Greek myths that had a wish that you this fellow who could wish for whatever he wanted, and he wished that he would never die, right? Which he was granted his wish. It was the most terrible wish that was ever granted in the whole world, right? Because he forgot to ask never to age. So he kept on getting older and older for hundreds of years and never dying. Yeah. Yeah. So this is where you start to understand. This is what I mean when I say that death is full of love. Death is allowing the new life to happen. So, you know, this idea that we can prolong life forever, yeah, maybe we can prolong it. I think these kinds of technologies are dubious ethically as well as being dubious metaphysically, but the biggest problem with it is, of course, we know very well how to extend life, right? And it's very cheap. You give people clean water, right? You can give people enough food to eat, right? You can give people mosquito nets, right? You can give people decent sewerage and toilets, right? Now, if you did those four things, you're going to extend more people's lives. But, of course, that's not very much fun. And after all those people are poor and black. So there's not really much point in extending their life, is it? Sorry to be a little bit cynical there, but, you know, all of these kind of immortality projects, surprisingly enough, you'll find that, hey, they end up extending the life of rich white men. Curious enough, yeah? Anyway. So rather than trying to extend life forever, what about, the Buddha turned the question on the head. He said, well, isn't the problem getting reborn? The problem is rebirth. And this is an incredible inversion of the whole normal set of values we look, isn't it? I mean, normally we rejoice at birth, right? And baby gets born, we're very happy and full of life and everything like that. And then when death comes, we're very sad. So the Buddha turns the problem on the head. The source of the problem is a problem that we're getting reborn. So to address this problem and to overcome that idea of getting reborn, we have to understand that these things, death and birth, are part of the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin. It's part of that same cycle. And so these contemplations of death, contemplation looking at your body, the impermanence of it, the nature of your body and so on, this is deepening our own awareness of what this cycle of life is all about. It's facing up to these fears, right? This fascination, right? That darkness of the unknown, right? Which keeps us from facing what our life is really like. And the reality is that our life is impermanent and it's drawing to an end. And this happens for everybody. Every single person in this room will die. Some people will die too young. Some people will die too old. Yeah? And not just the people in this room, but everything we ever known will die. All the people we know will die. This city will die. Our civilization will die. Our environment will die. Our planet will die. Maybe it will die too young. The Buddha talked about, again, this idea of internally, externally, and he would use this contemplation to look at, you know, the impermanence of your own bones and the body and so on, and then contemplate the impermanence of the earth. There will come a time, he said, when the waters and the earth dry up. Yeah? You imagine the power of the insight, right, of the Buddha the oceans are infinite, okay? So for the Buddha to understand that actually our earth will last for such a long time that there will come to time that the oceans will dry up, what an incredible insight that he had. Yeah? Yeah? So he had this idea that even this earth, all the life on the earth, everything about it will be impermanent, it will fail. All these things that we hold dear, all these things that we've worked so hard to build up, inevitably they will be gone. So we can't find this search for immortality and so on. This is a fool's errand. We can never find that. And when we can't find that immortality, what is left? If everything we do is going to become dust, what matters? So when we begin to understand like this, we begin to shift, right? We're not worried so much about what is the outcome, okay? Where am I going to be in 10 years' time? Well, you might be run over by a truck tonight, yeah? And all those plans for what you're doing in 10 years' time, okay, have plans, that's fine, you should have plans, whatever, but don't get too hung up on it. The thing that really matters is what are you doing now? One time the Buddha asked the monks about how they contemplated death, and one of the monks said, every time I begin to enter the rains retreat, then I remind myself that this may be the last rains retreat that I ever do. We do the rains retreat once a year. And the Buddha said, you slacker. Another monk said, well, every time I do the Upasita, we do every fortnight, the Upasita recitation, I think this may be the last Upasita that I ever do. So I'd better be diligent. And the Buddha said, you slacker. Another monk said, every time I walk for alms round to the village, you know, it's like it's an hour's walk there and back, and I think, you know, maybe this might be the last time that I ever go for alms round. And the Buddha said, you slacker. Another monk said, every time I start to eat a meal, I think maybe this might be my last meal. So I better be diligent. And the Buddha said, you slacker. Another monk said, well, every time I breathe in, I think maybe I'm not going to breathe out. And every time I breathe out, I think maybe I'm not going to breathe in. Yeah? The Buddha said, ah, finally, somebody who's really practicing. Yeah? So when we're really aware of that, really aware of that death, every breath becomes precious. One of those breaths will be your last. Yeah? So we act as if anyone might be our last. You live every minute of every day like it might be your last, because it really might. And we don't leave anything undone. Right? What would happen if you died today? What would happen if you died this minute? Is there something in your heart that you need to do? Is there somebody you need to talk to? Right? Is there something you need to solve? Is there something you need to ask forgiveness for? Is there something you've left undone? Don't go to bed at night without just leaving those things undone, you know? As a monk, I'm privileged, I think, to see death more than most people. And we do funerals and so on quite often. And one of the things that I have noticed is that most of the time in the Buddhist families, especially people who are meditators and who have some depth in their practice, that there really is a wisdom to the experience of loss. I did a funeral, I'm just remembering, a few years ago in Sydney, where it was a young family. They were in their, I think, late 30s, had a young daughter, was maybe, I think, 11 or 12 at the time, and the husband died very suddenly, and it was obviously very tragic, you know, and I spent some time with the family, and you could see how, you know, obviously they loved their father and husband so much. And then they gave the kind of the eulogy at the funeral, and I still remember the words. I don't remember the words, but I remember the short speech that was given by the daughter. She's only like 11 or 12. And I was so amazed at how much wisdom she had, you know, to be able to accept that love that she had for her father and the loss at the same time, and to understand that was something I thought was just phenomenal in a child of that age. And it really showed me that there's something about this Buddhist path and Buddhist practice that really does have meaning. Yeah. Another funeral I went to a few years ago was the wife died. She was, I think, about 40 at the time. And again, like, you know, someone who's very, very beloved. She was a doctor, and her family was, you know, they had a number of children, and they, you know, very loving, very warm family. And I did the funeral service for them, and the husband was too upset to do the eulogy, but he wrote a piece which was read out at the funeral. And one of the things that he said in there has also really stuck with me all that time, because what happened was that it was particularly tragic because the wife had died while giving birth. And she was pregnant, she gave birth, and then there was this very sudden complication, and she was dead within a few minutes. Completely unexpected, no history of it, nothing like that, just gone. But the baby was perfectly healthy and so on. So extraordinarily tragic event. And one of the things that he said, and this was a very brave thing for him to say in that eulogy, was that he said, if I had had 5 minutes more to spend with my wife, yeah, who I love so much, if I'd had 5 minutes warning and I'd been able to say to her anything that I could say, he said, there's nothing that I had to say to her. Yeah. We left nothing unsaid between us. And so for me, that was such a beautiful and moving account of what it really means to be present and what it really means to love and to be with somebody in that way. So we live, each breath we remember, it might be our last. One day it will be our last. By reminding ourselves of that reality of death and impermanence, it makes everything so much more precious. We don't live in order that we might live forever. We live in order to be present. Our legacy, the power of our legacy is not that we can make ourselves immortal, not that our fame can be immortal, or that our name, or that anything we set up or build or anything can last forever, because all of those things will become dust. Our legacy is our presence. Our legacy is, how do we breathe? Our legacy is, how do we live in the present? And if we can bring that full quality of presence and life to every minute that we live, then we will have lived a good life. So that's my little talk for you this evening on the contemplation of death. And I offer that for your reflection. And I think we probably have some questions. Thank you so much. Okay, so some interesting questions. Frank from Chiang Mai. Hello, Frank. How are you going? About 30 years ago, I was an ambulance officer. During that time, I came into contact with heavily injured and dead bodies. These experiences still haunt me today. What's the best way to deal with these images and emotions that are still coming up? Well, I mean, that's very striking, isn't it? I mean, that's a long time ago. For somebody, especially in a professional capacity, usually people... you know, you learn some coping mechanisms, right? And I'm not sure whether you were taught those, you know, any coping mechanisms in your kind of professional training. But usually, of course, it's something that, you know, students will have to face and have to overcome. But it's not an easy thing, and it still has an effect after a long time. So my best suggestion for you, to give this kind of personal advice, just from a, you know, a short saying like this, is difficult. So don't take anything I'm saying as being too fixed. It's just some suggestions. Okay. So, but what I would mainly suggest is to introduce a little bit of death contemplation, just gradually, and as you feel comfortable with it, in the context of your normal meditation. So if you're doing some breath meditation, then maybe just at the end of the breath meditation, then just bring up some of those images that are haunting you, and just bring that to mind and just look at it and just feel that response. feel the fear that comes or the anxiety or something like that, don't spend too long doing that, just a short time, just a minute or two. You feel that, and then ask yourself, can I fill that space with love instead? Can I have love and compassion rather than having the fear or the anxiety that comes? Can I have that love for that person who's died? Can I have the love for their relatives and all of the people who suffered through that? And so you just try to turn that emotion around, but like I said, just a little bit at a time. Don't be in a hurry at all, and just sort of planting those seeds. But like I said, that's just one suggestion, and see how you go with that. But I can't make any guarantees. Okay, next question. Raymond from Germany. How's it going, Raymond? In a shamanic journey, you can travel to the upper world, lower world, and have spiritual experiences and encounters. Do you think that these places are where we could be reborn? Possibly, yes. It's difficult to say. In different kinds of visions and vision quests and so on, the experiences that we have are a mixture of a subjective and objective. Right? Now, just to put this in a framework, from a Buddhist point of view, all of our experiences are a mixture of subjective and objective, right? I mean, we have our own perceptions, thoughts, ideas, and so on, and we interpret experience through that lens, right? Even the things that you see are still heavily filtered by perception, okay? And I'm sure that you're all aware of different studies and tests and so on that have been done that show this in sometimes quite extraordinary ways. One of the most famous ones is the one with the gorilla and the basketball, right? Do you know that one? No, you can probably find it on YouTube or something like that. But this is a film that was done. I saw it in a theatre or a hall in Sydney where Jon Kabat-Zinn was teaching, and he showed this. And I'd heard about this before, so I knew what was happening, so it didn't take me in. But what they do is they got two basketball teams, one wearing like about five or six guys in each team, and they have like one wearing light shirts, one wearing dark shirts. And then they're playing, and you have to count how many times the light-shirted ones are passing the ball, okay? And this clip goes on for like 3 or 4 minutes or something like that. So this is what you're asked to do. And so you're sitting there in the audience and you're checking this. Meanwhile, right, a man in a gorilla suit comes out in the video and stands in front of the camera and beats his chest, okay, and then runs off to the side, okay? And then you finish that, and then they ask you, how many times did the white-shirted team pass the ball? And, you know, people say it was like 6 times or 7 times and so on. They say, oh, okay, very good. And did you see the gorilla? Yeah? And people say, what gorilla? Huh? Seriously, I mean, it's just unbelievable. You cannot believe it. It wasn't as if it was hidden or subtle. There's a man standing in front of the camera in a gorilla suit beating his chest. And most of the people who see the video don't see him. It's just astonishing. Some of them didn't even see it when they watched it for a second time, and they'd been told that there was a man with a gorilla there. This is how perception works, right? Now, so if our perception is that unreliable in such a straightforward case, how much more so in these cases where we're doing vision quests and things like that, right? And so that in those situations, our subjective projections are even stronger. And the way that we interpret things is much more fluid, and that's of course especially in the case if there's been like if you're taking drugs or something like this, and your mind is confused and so on. Now that's not to say there's not any reality to it. It's just to say that we should be cautious about how we interpret any of these things. When the Buddha talked about these kinds of things, the ideal way of doing these things is to first develop the fourth jhana, and with the fourth jhana, your mind is incredibly still and clear, completely let go of all pleasant and unpleasant feelings, so neutral. And so when you see things from that kind of state, you see it with an incredible clarity and objectivity. It's just, you know, your mind isn't distorting things in that same way. And so this is why it's always much better to try to understand these experiences based on that kind of deep samadhi rather than on sort of trance states or drug-induced states or ritual-induced states and so on, which don't have the same depth of clarity of mind. You know, once again, not to say that that what they see is either true or untrue. It may be both. It's just to say that we should be cautious about interpreting those things. That's all. So to answer the question, you know, do I think that these places are where we could be reborn? I think it's quite possible, but I think it's hard to interpret it without looking at it more clearly. Okay, third question. I would like to do this meditation, presumably the meditation on bones, but what if contemplation of death brings about death? Ah. Never heard of that happen. Could that happen? Could contemplation of death bring about? I doubt it. Can this happen because I'm worried that if this meditation shortens life in some way? Ah, yeah. No, I wouldn't worry about that. I don't think it's going to shorten your life. I mean, unless you get suicidal or something, which if you do, you shouldn't be doing this meditation. But I don't think it's going to shorten your life. I think it will hopefully make you appreciate your life more and give you more vitality. But like I said earlier, if you do find that, you know, you're getting persistently a kind of negative or distressing emotional response from the meditation, then it's probably a good sign to stop. And if you get the chance or if you want to continue with it, then it's good to talk to an experienced teacher in person and to discuss it with them and do it under their guidance before continuing. Okay. So, any questions from people here? Yes. Sorry, I can because of the bright lights here, I can only vaguely see shapes in the audience, so I'm not really sure who I'm looking at. So
I have a 4-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
How do I speak to her skillfully about death?
I think that when... Look, I'm not an expert on child rearing, by the way, but I would think don't make a big deal of it. Yeah, just be natural. Don't make it into a taboo subject. I don't think it's anything. I don't think kids are going to be naturally afraid of death or anything like that. I think it's something we instill in them. I'll just say to a fellow, everyone dies. Yeah, and you know, I'm going to die. You're going to die sometime. And you know, don't try to hide it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, remember this, that story of the Bodhisattva and how the Buddha's father tried to hide these things from him. It never goes well, right? And, you know, kids are resilient. They'll get over it. They'll cope with it. And it's better if someone grows up before they even understand it, right? They know it. And then they it's part of their understanding as they grow up rather than sort of being a shock at some time to have to realize it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Over here.
I'd like to share when I lost my son. He was 30, and it was a very difficult time. But I found that on the day I had to identify him, I had choir on with my Buddhist community, and it was, do I stay home and shut off, or do I go out and share with my friends and with people that I really love? And fortunately, I went to the choir and I shared about that I'd lost my son, and of course I was very traumatized, crying, and they all chanted for my son and for myself. And in the chanting, I actually felt the strength and the vitality coming back into me that I could face what was happening. And then when I started to sing with the choir, I actually went from this state of hell and trauma to a state of joy. And I felt guilty that I was feeling this incredible joy arising when I had lost my son. But that was an amazing experience, and I knew that my prayers and everyone's prayers and the love that was helping my son with his next lifetime, and that I'm eternally connected. And It was an incredible experience that I faced my grief and then I could be joyful. Yeah, thank you.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah. Okay, so maybe we should finish up for this evening, and hopefully I will see you on Sunday for the course on Karma and Rebirth in Early Buddhism.